very much. Now, in anticipation that I probably wouldn't be here beyond one, I'm actually on a flight at 4:40, and I've got two hearings in Auckland tomorrow. So there's a summary, and I propose I just read that out. And
you can even summarise that if you like, because we've all used your evidence and your supplementary evidence. So
okay.
if you think that would speed things up.
Certainly. Because there's been some reflection and tweaking going on.
Okay.
Since I wrote my evidence and since I wrote that supplementary statement. So maybe I'll just go through and look for where I can show you where there are some further modifications.
Sorry, can I ask, so this is as you submitted and as we
read,
right. This is where you will show us?
Yes, correct. So there's nothing on page one. In relation to policy 6325, perhaps I'll just read paragraph 18 now. My preferred wording, and that's the paragraph reference in my evidence in chief of policy 6325, removes the reference to openness because it is identified by the environment called openness as a factor for outstanding landscapes but not other landscapes. And removes degrade as it is too absolute and replaces with RMA language. And on further reflection, I consider that the wording in my primary evidence, which was do not significantly adversely affect landscape, character, orchid, or amenity values, opens the door too far to adverse effects, and there's a better wording there which I'll let you read through. Now, also, just below that, is Objective 634, which I comment on, and Policy 6341, and the almost stark nature of Objective 634 and its non-qualification by inappropriate, which goes beyond the intent of Objective 3251. And I simply state that it should be reconsidered. And that's likely to have implications for the wording of the policies which serve it. In paragraph 21, most of those bullet points are simply a summary of what I've said in my evidence in chief. And in the fourth bullet point, fifth bullet point, I'm inserting the words "or appropriately" for remedies or mitigate, respectively, to give some discretion over the level of mitigation. Because as has been discussed today, just the word mitigate on its own could be a lot of mitigation or a little bit of mitigation. You could be achieving the policy with only a little bit, which might not go far enough in any particular case. So inserting the words "or appropriately" for mitigate at least gives the decision maker more discretion on that point.
Mr. Brown, could you ask, I think it's Mr. Gold's looking for, about whether there'd be times that we appropriate to say avoid or remedy as opposed goes to the board and we look at that. Where you want a higher bar versus the great exhibition by people's motivation.
Well, quite possibly, but are you talking for this policy or
no, generally? Just generally, sorry.
Possibly, but that would all depend on the provision itself and the evidential basis for it.
Yeah.
But as a general rule...
Is it possibility, would that be something that could be used to, in those places where you didn't want to allow this much mitigation?
Yeah, but quite, well, possibly, but I would need to, I'd need to sort of see where and what the evidence was for it. The rule 6412 and 6413 are the subject of the supplementary statement. And I thank the panel for allowing that to be on the record. And that is about all I need to say on the summary, so I'm happy to answer your question.
Without going through all the policies that you hold in respect of the avoid, do you think there's also potential with some of them to have avoid to the extent practical, or that you give a preference to avoid rather than just avoid remedy or mitigate or avoid or appropriately mitigate?
Yes. Again, on the basis that it would all depend on the circumstances of the provision itself and the evidence for it.
I'm trying to get a general knowing that
yes.
You need to get away, so rather than get required,
yes.
Just want to get the general concept.
Yes. Yep.
You also heard me ask Ms. Bolt whether their submissions were directed really to the Waikato Basin rather than the generality of the district. To what extent does your evidence and your suggestion related to the generality of the district rather than the Waikato Basin?
I was writing them with the whole district in mind.
Right. So when you talk about the issue of openness, you had in mind the openness, for instance, of the Hardware Flats.
Yeah, thinking generally, it's sort of Hardware Flats, those flats behind Wanaka, the Waikato Basin, any other areas where there's various aspects of openness.
The other question that followed also, and I think I thought it was Mr. Goldsworth, whether in fact the policy direction to suit the particular circumstances of the Waikato Basin should be the factor that controls the policy direction of the plan in terms of the rural areas.
No. I think if you're detecting any need for separation, then there should be that. I haven't been thinking about the differences. But if on the evidence, not just at this early stage, but all the way through, because you're going to hear lots about all of the land areas and zonings and so on, then it becomes apparent that there needs to be some differentiation at the higher level. so be it. But I hadn't. I had been thinking that we were dealing with the whole district at the strategic level.
Just turning to the issue of the Franklin Flats.
Oh yes.
And several commercial activities there. I'm wondering whether there's a way of expressing that better in terms of the description of what it is than what is in the plan. Whether it's a geographical area that's used as a descriptor rather than identifying several subcomponents, if you like. Have you given that any thought?
I was effectively leapfrogging off the Section 32A report, which did list those components, I'm pretty sure, in that policy that I've now amalgamated with the Queensland and Monica policy. It may be tidier just to do it by geography, geographical boundary.
It's a rather unusual situation, isn't it?
Yes, highly unusual.
Hard-pressed to think of somewhere in the Auckland urban area that has such disparate centres, but all to be treated as one.
Yes.
With an airport in the middle.
Yes, correct. Yeah. I think perhaps a geographical boundary, but would that need to then be shown on the maps? And would we then be folding in the Franklin Corner, for example, which I had thought was being dealt with in a slightly different way? It wasn't in the hub, the district's hub category.
Well, that's the uncertainty.
Mm. Yes. And if then there's going to be a line drawn around, say, the Remarkable Park Zone, the Franklin Flats A and B special zones and the airport, then it may be well just to name them. And not have a line on the map, but I think either way, as long as, from my point of view, that I just think it's tidier that all of them are folded into the same strategic direction, objective and policy, with Queenstown and Wanaka, because they're all economic hubs of the district.
Does your consideration of that geographic area, does that include the industrial land down at Glenda Drive?
Yes, it would, yeah.
Have you got any view on that submission about three parks, Ballantyne Road and Wanaka? It's a business area also. And we have no mention of that as a separate area. Have you got any view on that?
That's a very good point. And that is intended, as I understand it, to be into the second hub of Wanaka, with its own centre and various levels of density around it, and industry and business and so on. Whether for now, I'm actually not sure how progressed it is, because it's a while since I've been over there. In fact, not since Plan Change 45 last year have I been in and around there. But whether in its current state it would qualify as an economic hub, and whether that's something that might come along in the future, be elevated to the same status as Frankton already, given that Frankton Flats A zone is constructed, the Remarkable Park zone is well established, the airport's well established, the industrial zone is well established. It doesn't yet have that status, that at some point in the future it could well have.
A question followed up on that. Do you think the concept of an economic hub is sufficiently precise? I look around the district. Charlotte Jet's an economic hub. Skyline's an economic hub. Should we be looking for some other descriptor that better defines what we're talking about when we describe these areas, what their function is?
Given the... I can see your point. There's lots of little economic hubs. So I was reading that objective and the policies in a way that they are relating to the wider functions of the major town centres, as opposed to a range of other activities that are not necessarily contained within or taking place in a town centre or related commercial areas. So I think, and although it's non-RMA language, Economic Hub does sort of definitely send out a strong connotation of what those areas are.
Could I start by asking you to go to paragraph 4.6 in your evidence and sheet?
Yes.
Just in regard to the objective that's set out in here. Could you explain what's the environmental outcome, sort of goal of that objective, just in the way it's worded? I'll jump to the chase, Mr. Brown. Is it recognising something isn't an environmental outcome, as far as I understand it, and just recognising it wouldn't actually meet the what I thought might have been the criteria for being an objective. So I'm looking at both, and this is something consistent through parts of the plan that we've discussed with officers and other planning witnesses previously, and it's trying to get what are the correct objectives, what should they be, and then what are the correct policies. So while I've indicated that as an example, it's throughout the plan, and that whether there should be potentially better wording of what the objectives are, so it actually reflects the actual environmental outcome or intent, just from a planning practice point of view.
Yes.
And wanted to seek your views on that.
My reading of it in terms of an environmental outcome is that the rural areas have potential to diversify their land use beyond, in my words, with traditional rural activities, including farming. So it's enabling, but then regulating, because environmentally, while farmers could diversify their land use into other things, they need to do it in a way that doesn't have adverse effects, or that adverse effects are avoided, removed, or mitigated. So it was a objective, putting aside the words, simply trying to signal that it's not just farming, there's other things out there that the rural areas could sustain, if they're done right.
Is it, when you look at it that way, really an objective and also a policy? That it's two things.
It could work.
And may need to be broken in half.
Indeed.
I had some of your other slate. I didn't want to go into detail, where they probably need to be broken into splits, and it's probably not your fault because you've taken the notified group.
Yes, that's right. Yes, it's dealing with two things, and it could well be split.
I'll take all the rest of my questions regarding objectives and that as answered. The A general overall question that I don't think you addressed in your evidence, but I wanted to ask you because we've asked others. In the Chapter 3, it has goals and objectives and policies. In terms of the term goal that's used there, and how would that be considered by decision makers in regard to the 104D, if they look at objectives and policies? Is there a difference? Should they be called something different? Is it all the same?
Good question. I don't like having another level in there above objectives. And you're right, I haven't addressed it in the evidence, but...
I wanted to answer.
Yes.
As a planning practitioner, what's your view in terms of either calling them that or do you think they are objectives or...?
I'd need to work my way through them, but some of them could well be interpreted and maybe rewritten as objectives. And they could be simply amalgamated into the equivalent set of objectives for each one. And what I miss about this plan and other plans around the country is explanation of principal reasons for adoption, which have all been sort of taken out now in the interest of having a streamlined plan with less words. But I always found them really good guidance for what a particular chapter is actually trying to do. Maybe like a purpose statement, which we have, or some sort of concluding statement about environmental results is always a useful thing to me.
They have purpose and purpose.
And values, yeah.
Values and things.
And maybe that's the place for goals. If they're not to be integrated into objectives.
Paragraph 616 to 617 in your evidence?
Yes.
Just in regard to the inclusion of the words remedy and mitigate, does there come a point at which when you're particularly concerned with addressing cumulative effects, that remedy or mitigation may no longer be appropriate?
There could come a point.
How might that be addressed at that point?
By perhaps another provision which actually deals with potentially something that actually makes the assessor, whether it's an applicant or a decision-making body, think about whether the I don't want to use the word carrying capacity, but you know what I mean. The point at which
unable to absorb unable to absorb.
Yes, something like that. Yes. Without then there being adverse effects that can't be avoided.
In 621, page 24. The last sentence there where you're referring to your wording landscape values are one component in the overall determinant of applications. It might have been the way I was reading it, but if is landscapes only one component of the overall determination? So what I was looking at, is there a difference in the determination from that consideration? Sorry, I'll leave that one. That's in 633. So the change you have in the recommended in the objective there. Just it seemed to me that that changes it from what was an objective that was kind of framed in the negative to one that's framed in the positive to enable.
Correct.
What? How might that change the way decision makers might reach a determination when considering that provision?
Coupled with the policies, the additions, the existing policies and the additions, it's an over, I've used the word appropriate, and then policies and then determine how the decision maker would assess the appropriateness of it, working their way through all of those factors.
Just on the objective and the policies under it, I'm struggling to see how 635 can be an objective where we haven't made it appropriate, and 6353 can be a policy which has exactly the same wording, enable subdivision and development. Is there
The words of 6353, the policy, is endeavouring to expand what's in the objective. It's almost in the same way that the original wording of it is notified, simply expanded. What's in the objective and taking it further as to how it would be assessed.
If the policy is to somehow give form and character to the objective, that's what you were suggesting, would it be simpler to just say only allow subdivision development, which would already mitigate those things?
instead of deleting the only putting the label in, because you've already said that the objective is to enable
yes.
development in those areas.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And bear in mind, in my summary statement, that's where I've inserted the word or appropriately remedies and mitigates adverse effects to give the decision maker latitude as to how far the remedying or mitigating actually goes.
Yeah.
Does it go far enough? If not, doesn't avoid, therefore refuse.
Last one just relates to the rules in 641, and I'm not commenting on supplementary about it as well. In your view, are those provisions that are there, are they actually rules or something else?
Very good question. I wasn't really sure. That's where I thought a explanation type statement would have been better rather than a rule.
In terms of your the amendments you've made to them, do they make them more like an explanatory statement?
I was still trying to frame them as rules, but you know, just because that's how it's already framed in the notifier. But I think the message can be made without it actually needing to be a rule.
Thank you.
Following up on that, there was an extensive discussion that I felt a conference had with your various legal counsel about effectively tail wagging the dog in terms of deciding that something is not outstanding, for instance, because it's not in the rural zone. Do you have a planning view on the proposition I was putting, that you identify your outstanding natural features and outstanding natural landscapes first, and then the policies will flow as a matter of course from the fact that they're outstanding in Section 6B?
Yes, I think there's a factual assessment first, determine them, and then express what resource management provisions is going to be applied to them.
Yes. And you, in that second phrase, is going to be done as regards the O&Ls and O&Fs by reference to Section 6B, I take it. You accept that? Or
yes, I accept that. Yes.
Now, I want to ask you a general point. Skirted around it, you've added the word appropriately in a number of places. My question is an objective or policy saying to enable something if it's appropriate, does that need to be backed up? Or my initial reaction looking at it is that that adds no value, and I have to admit I've thought that about the number of your suggested amendments, that it doesn't tell me what the result is, which suggests that the decision makers down the track will have an absolutely open discretion. Now, have I misread your intent? Am I missing something, basically?
No, I don't think you're missing something. My intention was to give as much direction as possible without actually give as much direction as possible given the wide variety of circumstances that may or may not come along with any application.
In relation to the basic argument you're setting out, the chain of reasoning, that we'll use argument pejoratively, that there's too much emphasis on farming. The proposition I have for you is that, bearing in mind that everyone likes to refer to what Judge Jackson's court said in 1999, one of the things that he said, he and his team said, was that the ultimate end game to be avoided was excessive domestication. And in a planning sense, at what point, what produces domestication? What is it that we're seeking to avoid in the rural landscapes if domestication is the thing to be avoided?
Proliferation of dwellings, that's domestic, with all of the signals that go with domestication. And from memory of C-180-99, the judge was talking about things that go along with any normal dwelling, like washing lines and garages and gates, letterboxes, swimming pools, sheds, kids' bikes lying around, all of those sorts of things. And not to say that you don't have those things around your dwelling, because it's just perfectly normal to do so, but you avoid or you remedy or you mitigate the effects of those by where you site your dwelling and your curtilage areas, how you screen it or otherwise mitigate it when viewed from public places. So you still have some domestication for each dwelling, but in the first place, the location of the dwelling and how it's positioned in the landscape and how it reads from externally, maybe from public places, all need to be considered. And the C-180-99 objectives and policies, and then the subsequent decisions which provide all the assessment matters, go into that in some detail.
Where do golf courses fit? If we cover the Wakatipu Basin end-to-end with golf courses, is that a desirable outcome?
I don't think golf courses look that bad. They're wide open spaces. Depending on what development is proposed to go along with the golf course, given that it's very expensive to build a golf course without having some real estate that goes with it, because one pays for the other. But again, if the way it's developed, its location, its external effects visually, are all managed, then more golf courses can come along. I'm sure the basin or the Hawea Flats could absorb more. And I've actually been involved in two golf course proposals that actually never got off the ground over in the Hawea Flats. And of course, there's that little 9-hole course just south of the Hawea Turnoff. On the state highway, so this, and that's you know, that's fine. Whether it's got sheep on it or people on it, hitting a golf ball, I still think it's a level of amenity that we can sustain.
And in terms of the set, it provided those issues of managed what end result? What are you trying to achieve with the management mechanisms we're putting in place? Using the golf courses as an example.
Areas of areas that are not developed, large areas that are not developed, and if there is development, then it's carefully sited, carefully effects carefully mitigated.
I asked whether one of the key attributes of the hills is no one can see it. Is that an objective that we should have?
No, I don't think so. I think that's just the way that particular golf course has evolved. And I think will continue to evolve, which you'll hear more about later in the year.
In your suggested 3-2-1-4, you said beyond traditional rural activities, including farming. What sort of traditional rural activities do you have in mind, other than farming?
They're mostly farming. So you could say skiing. Skiing is traditional, given that the early ski fields were in the middle of last century.
Should we move from deciding what's traditional, which is almost like deciding what's historic,
yes,
to how old you are, to focus on existing activities? Is traditional history the relevant criteria?
Not really. I was simply putting in alternative words to strong productive value of farming. Because I think that was sending out the wrong position. Because there may be one or two farms that have productive value, but certainly as a general rule for the district, strong productive value of farming, I would have thought, was a strong characteristic. And having just been sitting for the last couple of years through the Auckland unitary plan, there are. Prime and elite soils, vast hectares of them in South Auckland through to the Waikato border, which are truly New Zealand's food basket. They're the only places that you can get several crops a year for most crops. Nowhere else in the country can do that. So that's the sort of comparison I'm making. The extremely strong productive value there, but far less so in the Queensland Lakes.
Can I ask you to go to your 4-2-5?
Paragraph 4-2-5?
Yes. You've inserted reference to activities relying on rural resources. Mm-hmm. And the issue I want to put to you is that every house that's in the rural landscape relies on rural resources because it relies on a patch of bare dirt. So do you think that phraseology provides sufficient guidance?
With the rest of the provisions, I think it does. Again, I'm expanding the horizon from agricultural land use and the objective and farming and the policy so that more activities are recognised in the rural areas, and particularly now. Lower Clutha Basin's got quite a few golf courses. There's one or two elsewhere in the district. Those things, existing things and future things, I think need to be recognised.
Question for you in 619. This is the you've suggested that we 6322 be moved to a more focus on whether it can absorb rural living development. Do we need more guidance as to what that means? Because can absorb it without doing what?
I've endeavoured to qualify it with the last part of that sentence, which tries to deal with potential adverse effects on landscape character and visual amenity values. I've said properly considered in the intent in the middle of that clause, which is that adverse effects are avoided or adequately remedied or mitigated.
I suppose properly considered doesn't really tell me a lot, other than there will be a detailed examination, but it doesn't tell me what the course of action is going to be, other than that it will be considered.
Again, the intent of this is to make sure that people are focusing on assessing all of those effects, landscape character and visual amenity values, which they would do